Good morning.
That's because he's going to pick on me.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, actually, I'm not going to pick on you very much today. Good morning. I'm Charles Lane. The session this morning is entitled Our Living Earth and subtitled Earth Circles. And before we roll a whole lot farther, just want to cast around the room real quick and see who is here today that was not here to hear me yesterday. Is there anybody new in here today? I was hoping that Carla Birkendahl would be in by this point in time because she was asking last night. She's the director of this Earth Ministry out of Seattle, connecting people with creation, which is a ministry of the Episcopal Church. And she was asking the question, not directly of me last night, but asking the question about me, whether or not I had waxed very theological last week in my discussion on glaciers and volcanoes of the Pacific Northwest. And the honest answer to that is that I had not, other than if St. Helens is blowing, why run and pray all at the same time?
St. Helens.
And so I have not waxed very theological, and the reason I'm sorry she's not in here yet is that that's exactly what I'm going to do to start off the session this morning, is wax a little bit on the theological side. A close friend of mine is a fellow who's a professor of Old Testament theology at the Lutheran Southeastern Seminary in Charleston, South Carolina. His name is Lamont Luker. Ring any bells? Monty Luker? Monty Luker and I started out together a number of years ago at Cal Lutheran, and we were officed fairly close to one another and sitting around kind of chewing the fat and kicking it all around one day, and Monty leaned back in his chair and he sighed and said, "Oh, all of you geologists," here she is, she can hear this now, "all of you geologists, you're so Hebrew." And I said, "Come again?" And he said, "You're so Hebrew." And I said, "Okay, explain that to me." And he said, "You are so like the ancient Hebrews. You are so earthy. There is a holistic sense about you that all life and all living is tied so closely to the earth." And it sort of struck me, because he's exactly right. Believe it or not, and this may be kind of hard for a great many of you to follow, but one of my favorite parts of the Bible are the first few chapters of Genesis. And you might think, a scientist, and especially a geologist, thinking that the first few chapters of Genesis are part of his favorite reading, but it is. It's some of my favorite reading because the first few chapters of Genesis have such powerful symbology for me with respect to this concept of the earth to God's creation, to earth to God's creation. And those of you who were listening to Fred Niedner yesterday morning, he was talking about Adamas, Adam, Adamas. From dust I have created you, I give you life, and back to dust you shall return. And that has great symbology for me. And also, further down when we have the Cain and Abel story, and God asks Cain where Abel is, and Abel says, "I'm not my brother's keeper." And God says, "But I hear his blood crying out from the ground." And this is extraordinary symbology to me about the circles of life and how intimately tied this is to the creation and to the earth on which we live. And here's the part where I was going to poke a little fun at Ted and tell you all that he's not one of my favorite contemporary theological writers. Sorry, Ted. By saying that one of my favorite contemporary theological writers is a man named Matthew Fox. And some of you know him. He has several books. He has a marvelous book on being a musical mystical bear, in which he takes you through a wonderful discourse on the experiential nature of the triune identity of God, which is just wonderful and delightful. But his most powerful book for me is the one that is entitled Compassion. And he's very careful to define compassion for us by saying that it is shared passions, that at its root the word compassion means shared passions. And he has a chapter in there that is sort of the starting point for what I want to do. Believe it or not, this is my theological discourse leading into science now. But he has a chapter in there entitled Dancing Sarah's Circle. And you all remember growing up and singing that song about climbing Jacob's ladder, right? We are climbing Jacob's ladder. And Matthew Fox says this is awful, that this is terrible, that this is the worst possible kind of theology one can introduce their children to, climbing the ladder to heaven and somebody above you and somebody below you on the rungs and this sort of stuff. And his response to that is for us all to dance Sarah's circle, that we are all in a circle, that we're all at the same level, that we all have our feet planted firmly on the ground, and that our relationship to heaven and earth and to one another is a totality, is a holism. And that, in a great sense, is a summation of Matthew Fox's theology, just in that one chapter of his book, Compassion, that we are all engaged in dancing Sarah's circle. Where I come from in this is that Sarah's circle and those Genesis passages speak to a great circle of life that involves virtually everything on this sphere. And so, to get back more into the scientific venue now, I want to muse a little bit today about the nature of circles associated with a sphere and associated with living and being on this globe. And in some respects, there's perhaps a little bit of a voice in the back of your head kicking around that says that, gee, this sort of makes sense. You know, you sit here and you look at this sphere. Yesterday we talked a little bit about some of the oddities of living on a sphere, and especially one that is spinning. And we talked a little bit about how, even though the International Dateline, for example, is a man-made, person-made construct, that still is a reality. It's a very strange and wonderful reality of living on a spinning sphere. There's a great relationship between circles and spheres. And you think about the equator circling the globe, you know, it's the kind of words we use and the imagery we use. And all these other lines that go around the globe circle it as well. Of course, these lines of latitude go around like this, and the lines of longitude go around like this. And they're the same, and yet they're sort of different. Every line of longitude is, in fact, what mathematicians and other scientists refer to as a great circle, because it cuts the globe exactly in half. You ever notice that? All of the lines of longitude, you get to the North Pole, they all converge, and they go right through the pole. It doesn't happen with the lines of latitude. It's more like chopping off the top of a potato or a carrot. And so all lines of longitude converge and go through the poles. And this is what would enable you guys to be navigators on international airline flights, right? I just set you up for a new career. You want to learn how to be a navigator on a commercial airline, you need to learn to fly great circles. Because when you live on the surface of a sphere, shortest line between two points is not a straight line. It's a great circle. So if you want to fly from Los Angeles over here to, shall we go to Oslo, something like that, we're going to fly on a great circle route that actually takes us off over Greenland to get there. It's actually a rather painless this rather painless introduction into something that's called, this is entirely parenthetical now, but I just thought of this morning and thought it'd be fun to try out on you guys, since you're something of a captive audience. It's a rather painless introduction to what scientists refer to as non-Euclidean geometry. You guys all remember high school geometry and how much fun that was? How much you enjoyed that, and all of that geometry was Euclidean, because it's the stuff Euclid had put together. And one of the fundamental tenets of Euclidean geometry is that three internal angles of a triangle all add up to 180 degrees. Remember that? That's only true in Euclidean geometry. It's not true in non-Euclidean geometry. In other words, if I drew, and I won't, but if I drew that same triangle on the surface of the sphere, the internal angles would add up to more than 180 degrees, because you're on the surface of a sphere rather than on a plane surface, which is why Euclidean geometry is called plane geometry. That is one of two types of non-Euclidean geometry. If you have what looks like the bell of a horn or a trumpet, something like that, going up like this, so envision this is the bell at the bottom part of the trumpet, you know, Doc Severson's mouth's up at the other end. And actually, if you take two of them and put them together, you get a figure that looks kind of like this, and I think you can kind of envision three dimensions. But if you draw a triangle on the face of the bell, the internal angles add up to less than 180 degrees. This is actually called Riemann geometry, after the fellow who first thought of this stuff. And obviously the other one is called spherical geometry, by being on a sphere. And now you guys are all perfectly talented mathematicians in non-Euclidean geometry. That's all there is. That's how it works. See, it wasn't painless at all, was it? Or painful at all. It was really very painless.
Huh?
Okay. I'll leave this story at Zappa. But when you start dealing with spheres, you start dealing with circles as well. And I'd like to launch into a little bit of that. And to begin that, I'd like to take this spinning sphere in space and make a statement about solar energy, to begin with. And on the cosmic scale of things, solar energy is basically what we have. There's a certain amount of heat energy that is generated within the Earth, but except for earthquakes and volcanoes, there's not much manifestation of that, other than the occasional hot springs to jump into. The globe is fundamentally powered by solar energy. And it's powered by solar energy to the tune of something called a Langley. 1.94 Langleys per second is something called the solar constant. Okay? What that means is the sun, unless it's going through some kind of sunspot activity, and there are cycles in that as well, but unless the sun's going through some kind of sunspot activity, basically there is a constant amount of solar energy that impacts upon the Earth's atmosphere day in, day out, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, year after year after year. And that energy actually has been quantified. This is what science is good for, quantification of things. Langley, this American physicist, astronomer, all-around good guy scientist. And a Langley in and of itself is defined as a calorie per square centimeter. Now, remembering back to your junior high physical science class, because you didn't bother with chemistry in high school, right? The geometry was the end right there. Remember back to your physical science class in junior high school, calorie is the amount of heat energy it takes to warm 1 gram or 1 cubic centimeter of water by 1 degree centigrade. Okay? So that's kind of the measure of it. 1.94 calories per centimeters squared, which is about half of an inch squared, per second. That's the energy that comes into the Earth in the form of the solar constant. That's the energy the sun gives the planet and basically drives all the planet's processes, makes life possible. Doesn't come in the same shape all the time. Well, yes, it does. It comes in different forms of the electromagnetic spectrum. That's what I meant to say. And it comes in most intensely in the area around the equator. Now, second discourse, electromagnetic radiation. All this energy, we walk out, we feel the sunshine on our skin. Some of you, if you have skin like mine, you feel it more than others. Okay? But you feel this energy. It's all part of what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. And you guys have all known about this all of your life, perhaps never in any sort of focused fashion, but you know all about radio waves when you turn on your radio. You all know about microwaves when you do something in your microwave oven at home. You all know about x-rays when you're in the dentist chair and they drape that big lead thing over you and then they all skedaddle out of the room. Okay? You know all about that sort of stuff. You can see the visible light spectrum. You've seen it broken up into colors in a prism, and you've heard about ultraviolet and infrared. All of that is part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and all of those things come waltzing to the planet. Some get through the atmosphere more easily than others, some don't. Radio waves. We're all sitting here in this room. There are radio waves passing through our bodies right now, as you sit there and as I speak. Air is full of radio waves. Our bodies are basically invisible to them. Okay, so it's no big deal. X-rays, something else again entirely. That's why the X-ray technician at the dentist's office takes a hike. Right? They can have a cumulative effect that is not pleasant, so they figure, you're not in there doing this all day long. I am, so I'm not going to be in there doing this all day long. I'm going to get out of sight around the room behind some kind of lead protection and not be exposed to this. All right, now, Earth's surface, sun is out shining brightly off over here someplace. This radiation comes to the Earth's surface and warms it up. Now, fortunately for us, all of this heat energy does not stay here very long, else this would not be a very good place to live. This heat energy is re-radiated. It is re-radiated back into space. Now, the thing of it is that the Earth, fortunately, is a much cooler body than the sun, and so it is re-radiated at a lower wavelength and a lower energy, and the result is not unlike the things that you folks have seen at museums and, rock and mineral shows. Remember all those neat black light displays? You know, the ones where you go in and you turn on the black light and the minerals glow in the dark. What happens there is that the black light, the ultraviolet, stuff you and I had in our rooms in college, Jimi Hendrix posters on the wall glowing in the dark. What happens is that ultraviolet comes in at a very high energy. The mineral takes that in and that energy needs to be dissipated, returned back away from the mineral, and it's done so in the visible light spectrum. It fluoresces in colors that we can see. Same thing happens here. We get a great deal of energy in the visible light spectrum, and it gets re-radiated in the infrared, where we cannot see it very well. And every last one of you knows about this. Again, if you've not put it in any kind of formal setting or focused on it, every one of you knows this because every one of you has gotten into your car on a sunny day that is nevertheless the mineral of January someplace when it's cold out. Because you've gotten in your car and you go, ah. Because your car, the inside of your car, is warmer than the outside air. That's why in Texas we buy white cars and why in Alaska you should buy a black car. Because it actually holds the heat a little bit better even. But the thing of it is that you can get this radiation coming through the top of the car, and the car is fortunately much cooler than the sun, and it re-radiates it at a much lower wavelength, and it gets trapped. The greenhouse effect. Okay? The greenhouse effect. Now that's fundamentally how it works. The atmosphere of the Earth is fundamentally invisible to white light and a lot of other things, white light being the visible light. And most of the atmosphere, for the most part, is invisible to infrared as it turns around and goes the other way. All right, now, we'll pick on somebody. Anybody wants to take a stab at this? Two principal gases in the atmosphere.
Nitrogen, oxygen.
Remember the amounts?
2080, roughly. 79.
Roughly 2080. I will call it today as about 78% nitrogen and about 21% oxygen, obviously. But give you those numbers, that totals up to about 99% of the atmosphere. Now, notice the way that I wrote that, N2 and O2. Those things are found in the atmosphere in what we call a diatomic state. And you can write it graphically by doing something like this. Two oxygen molecules together, two nitrogen molecules together. Invisible to electromagnetic radiation coming in from the sun, invisible to the lower energy electromagnetic radiation, infrared radiation, that's reflected back out of the Earth, back out to the atmosphere. The key is the fact that they are diatomic molecules. What's that formula for?
Water.
See, you could have taken high school chemistry. You all see it as H2O with a little subscript O. You can always tell an organic chemist, because an organic chemist refuses to write H2O as H2O. They write it like this, and they even put the H's down, kind of canted a little bit to represent that 109 degrees between bonds to the hydrogen. H2O. How about this one? Carbon dioxide, CO2. How about this one?
Ozone,
O3. Notice the similarity? Notice what they have in common? They're triads. And it makes all the difference in the world, because those triads, when infrared radiation comes back off the surface of the Earth into the atmosphere and strikes these triads, they start flapping their wings. This Wiener's thing in his book. And what it does is it re-radiates that infrared radiation in all kinds of directions, rather than letting it pass back out through the surface of the atmosphere and that heat energy get lost back into space. The difference is just by adding that extra molecule. These are the common greenhouse gases. There is water vapor in the air. Ask anybody who comes from the Texas Gulf Coast. They can tell you that. There is ozone in the air. Ask anyone who's been in a bad smog day in Los Angeles, and they can tell you that. Especially if they've had to walk or run and get that burning sensation in their lungs. Of course, one of the odd things.
Nitrous oxides. Nitrous oxides out there too.
There are all kinds of things out there, as a matter of fact. The thing of it is that these greenhouse gases, we call them, have the same effect as your car on a sunny yet cold day in the winter. And they trap the heat released from the surface of the Earth and not let it get back out into space. Fairly natural to have water vapor in the air. It's also, on a global scale, pretty natural to have carbon dioxide in the air, part of the whole photosynthetic respiration process. And it's not unnatural to have ozone in the air. In fact, we need to have ozone in the air because that's our ultraviolet shield way up there in the stratosphere. And way up in the stratosphere is an awfully good place to have ozone. Down low in the troposphere, next to the surface of the planet, is a terrible place to have ozone. All right, let's stretch your imagination just a little bit. Now that we've got you enrolling on this chemistry business,
Nothing.
Now, this isn't fair. You're a chemistry professor, right?
I'm an engineer.
All right. The engineer will handle this too. We can do this. Methane, CH4. If anything, it is a much more effective greenhouse gas than the things that are cryogens. Much more effective. 20 times more effective. Watch this magical transformation. Now, you can't answer these next two questions. I'm going to let somebody else have a shot at it. One there. Anybody want to take a stab other than our engineer?
Chlorofluorocarbon.
Trichlorofluorocarbon, which is CFC11. Okay. Now that we've got that one down, see, this is. You guys are going to thank me for this about how easy I made organic chemistry, right?
Where's my grade?
You're all going to get an A from this because nobody's sitting there going, wow. All right, now, same line of reasoning. What's the, give it a name. Same line of reasoning as last time.
Dichlorocarbon.
Dichlorofluorocarbon. CFC. The two most common forms of chlorofluorocarbons. You see their relationship to methane? What they did is strip the hydrogens off of it and substitute chlorines and fluorines in their place. We'll come back to this a little bit later today because I've got some other ground I'd like to cover. But the thing that's real interesting here is that if we sort of view the surface of the Earth and these greenhouse gases kind of forming a line above here, a ceiling to the atmosphere, if you will, and we have all of this infrared radiation escaping off the surface of the Earth only to be trapped by water vapor and carbon dioxide and ozone in the troposphere, in the lower parts of the atmosphere. There's a window. Now, this is very diagrammatic because in reality it has to do with the particular wavelengths in the infrared that get tracked, but this will suffice. There's a window in here through which the infrared radiation can escape and make this green as it otherwise would be. And methane, CH4, we'll put that in there just like that. It just so happens those substances neatly fit that window. It just so happens that these substances, methane, CFC12, CFC11, fit the window and sort of block off the last escape route. We'll come come back to this. Let me go on to a couple of other things that perhaps you've intuited to a certain extent but had never given that much thought to. This business of the greatest amount of the sun's energy coming in at the equator has some interesting ramifications because we're on a spinning sphere. There's an elementary law of physics and thermodynamics that in effect states that heat flows from warmer objects to colder. And I would suspect that the vast majority of you have a certain amount of experience with that with respect to going to bed first on a winter's night and then having your spouse come to bed later. And he or she snuggles up to you and says, "Oh, you are so warm," and then promptly proceeds to wrap those ice-cold feet and legs around your nice warm toes in order to get warmed up. So see, you're all elementary physicists, too. You know? So you have an intuitive handle on all of this stuff. Has to work the same way on the surface of the Earth. All of this radiant heat energy comes in at the equator. Where is the coldest places on the Earth? North Pole, South Pole. That heat energy must move from the equator to the poles. Law of physics. Were that not the case, both places would be uninhabitable. So you must transfer that heat energy from the equator to the poles. Now, in order to pull that off on a spinning sphere, things tend to get a little complicated. If the sphere were not spinning, if there were no rotational axis and the sphere were not spinning, then this heat energy would just come in here and just flow in a nice straight line all the way up to the poles, and from there just sort of wick off into space, if you will. But because the globe is spinning, we have complications. And those complications end up being some of the most sublime circles that the physical sciences can describe. We describe it. You want to take a stab at what I'm going to do next? You want to guess me in advance? Let that go. We describe it in terms of something that we call the Coriolis effect. And it works something like this.
Could you write that out there for us so we can see it?
We're going to do the Coriolis effect, and I'm going to pick on you again, Ted.
I didn't say anything.
And I'm sorry, help me with your name, Ted's wife.
Jenny.
All right. Picture Ted Jenny at Disneyland. Back in the 50s, she was a child bride, he a much older man. All right? It's the 50s in Disneyland, and they have gone to the merry-go-round. Okay, here's the center of the merry-go-round, and I can't draw one of those merry-go-round horses from on top very well, so I'll just sort of represent it by this rectangle shape. So here they are sitting on these two horses on the merry-go-round, which of course the idea is for it to spin around. Now, Jenny, you're on the inside right here, and Ted, you're on the outside right here. You're young, you're in love, and lemonade costs 25 cents. I couldn't pick on anybody young to do this because no way lemonade costs 25 cents anymore. So I'd pick on Ted and put it back in the 50s. All right, so at any rate, Jenny is sitting on the inside of the merry-go-round. She says, "Ted, darling, I would really like a lemonade." And Ted says, "You mean right now while we're riding on the merry-go-round?" She says, "Yes, I really would, right now. Would you please get off and get me some lemonade?" And Ted says, "But I don't have any money." And Jenny says, "Yeah, well, that's about typical." So at any rate, well, at least that's the way it is in our marriage. And so at any rate, the idea is Jenny, of course, fishes the 25-cent piece out of her own pocket, looks over there at Ted and gives him kind of a dirty look, and then throws that quarter straight at him. With what result?
Misses behind.
Misses behind. I mean, And this was intuitive. You all intuited this just fine. As she threw this, it missed behind. Now, she's not Nolan Ryan, and that's not a round baseball that she can do magical things with. She did not throw a curveball. She took that coin and she threw it in a straight line over toward Ted. But for us, up above the merry-go-round, looking down on this, that path must describe a curved line. It absolutely must. This horse right here is not going as far as this horse is going in order to get back to the same place at the same time. Believe it or not, Ted, you were moving at a faster velocity than she was. This must follow a curved path. That, in short, is the Coriolis effect. And it pops up in unusual places. Were we to take this apparatus out here for the fireplace entirely and hang a big ball joint up there and set ourselves up a pendulum, and they've got this actually in several places. I've got one in the Denver Museum, and Foucault's pendulum is in France. But all of these little candle things that we have here, if we set them out around the edge of the fire pit and I start the pendulum swinging and it goes down low enough that it could actually touch one of these little blue candle holders. But I set them around such that when I start the pendulum swinging here, and let it swing straight over towards you, all the rest of the cups are around on all sides here and the pendulum doesn't touch them. But then all of us walk out of the room and don't come back here till this time tomorrow, and all of them will be knocked over. It's the Coriolis effect. Some of the German artillery officers in World War I found this out the hard way, which was good news for the French at first till they finally figured it out. But you remember some of the stories of Big Bertha, that big railroad car gun, where the Germans parked it about 70 miles away from Paris, took a shot and missed. Miss Paris. The Coriolis effect. When you try to have something move in a straight line counter to something that is spinning, the Coriolis effect is the result. And this drives everything. This drives absolutely everything. You watch the weather forecast, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter if you're in Duluth, Minnesota, or if you're in the Bay Area, or wherever is home, you're watching the weather and you see those clouds looping around and you see those storms going around and around and around in those circles. That's the Coriolis effect. That's heat energy from the equator trying to make its way to the poles. Those of you who vacation in the summer in San Diego, I'll admit that that sounds like a pretty pleasant idea to me, okay? But you vacation in the summer. Listen, it's the height of the summer, it's August. And you get in the water off San Diego, do a little swimming. How long are you gonna stay in the water?
An
hour. Hour? Is he gonna stay in an hour? They're not so sure you're gonna stay in an hour, neither am I.
Depends on your constitution. Our kids go to the ocean all the time, and they live in Southern California. We didn't want our pool because it was too cold. The pool is hotter than the ocean. It's a matter of attitude.
Sure, you can be in San Diego, and you're a good one to pick on. We'll come back to you in this just a second. You can be in San Diego in July and August, and you still better have your wetsuit on if you want to stay out in the water for very long. Now tell us about Coney Island, or better yet, tell us that you've taken a trip up to Cape Cod sometime in July or August and gone in the water off Cape Cod. Now, how long did you stay in the water? Hour or so?
Not very long, actually.
It's much warmer.
Those of you who try the experiment to go both places, you'll stay in the water in Cape Cod much longer. Even though Massachusetts is way up here on the East Coast and San Diego is way down here on the West Coast, there's no comparison. In fact, there may be as much as 15 degrees Fahrenheit difference between those water temperatures. it may be a difference of 60 degrees to 75 degrees. Coriolis effect is responsible for that. And again, you guys all have known this, just perhaps didn't give it that much thought. This is a poor rendition of Florida and on up the east coast of the United States. And over here, the British Isles and France coming out in the Bay of Biscay and down to the Iberian Peninsula and West Africa, this sort of thing. We have the Gulf Stream. You've known about it all your lives. No big deal, no big story. It's that warm water current that is bringing that warm water up from equatorial regions along the east coast of the United States, past Cape Cod, Grand Banks, out like this, meets up with some colder water coming down from the Baffin Islands area of Canada, of course, gets up here south of Greenland, makes Iceland a little more habitable by bringing some of this warm water, mixes with some more colder water off over here, makes for that great stormy weather in the Shetlands and northern Scotland, the Hebrides, this sort of stuff, and cools off rather dramatically before it makes its passage back down through the Bay of Biscay and around the Iberian Peninsula and the North Atlantic coast as a cold water current. The circle, the unbroken circle, the Gulf Stream heading north, this cold water current heading south. Same thing happens in the Pacific, by the way. Those of you Bay Area folks, you don't really do a whole lot of swimming out of Golden Gate. But if you were in Tokyo, which is basically about the same latitude on the other side of the Pacific, you know, you've seen the pictures of all the pearl divers, and they're not overdressed for the occasion. The water temperature is dramatically warmer. This is a blessing and a curse. I mean, if you like to swim in the ocean a lot, you've got to get a wetsuit if you're going to be in California, where you can be up and down the East Coast having a wonderful time. Of course, the flip side is that cold water is what gives California that California climate. The endless summer with days that are not very hot and nights that are not very cold. And if, and this is still something of a mystery, if you get to about that 80 degree Fahrenheit mark in the Gulf Stream or any other warm water stream, that appears to be the kickoff temperature for hurricanes and typhoons. It's almost mystical how that works. But if you get up to that temperature fairly early in the season, it's going to be a nasty hurricane season. Earth circles. Earth circles in the world's ocean currents.
Why do they go clockwise?
They go clockwise in the northern hemisphere because of the direction of rotation of the Earth. They go counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. And this is a good place to go from the wonderfully sublime to the perfectly ridiculous. I'm glad you inspired me to that. But this is experiential in your everyday life. When you go in the morning and take a shower, take a look at the direction that the water circles down the drain. And I'm here to tell you, in absolute certain terms, that if you were in the southern hemisphere, it would go the opposite direction. And interestingly enough, I've never experienced this, but I talked with a student once who had been in the military and had pulled some duty out here in the Gilberts. I don't know if he was in Howland Island or something out here in the Gilberts, but basically on the equator. And I asked him this. It takes a different sort of person, I admit. But I had asked him this, and I said, what does the water do as it goes down the drain at the equator? And he said it basically just falls in evenly from all sides, which is like water going to a waterfall. As a matter of fact, the Coriolis effect is as important as anything that is operating on the planet, because we have the equatorial highs, or the equatorial lows, I'm sorry, we have the equatorial lows, the low pressure system. And that comes from, that of course comes from the sun beating down, the sun warms the air, warm air rises, so we have the equatorial lows. And we have the polar highs, okay? There's not much sun, the air is very cold, dense, just kind of sits there. But in between, we have high and low pressures dancing through the atmosphere all over the place as a result of the Coriolis effect. All of those circles, those low pressures spinning counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere, spinning clockwise in the southern hemisphere, and the high pressures opposite each, obviously, dancing all over the globe as a result of trying to export this heat energy from the equator to the poles. And there is a certain, it's so dynamic that you can actually get an exportation across the equator as well. It takes a longer period of time to accomplish. El Nino helps with this. You guys all have heard El Nino, right? When was the first time you really started to pay serious attention to it?
10 years
ago. 1982. That actually is kind of an important thing and kind of a key thing. The Peruvians have known about it for a good many years. But it's like jumping into the bathtub and the warm water sloshes from the end of the bathtub that you jumped into, especially if you go to England. I don't know how many of you visited England, but my fondest remembrance of England is that they have these enormous long bathtubs that you can, if you, of course you can't get enough hot water,
which is the
flip side to that. But if it's a fairly nice day, you fill that bathtub and you can just float in there, you know, you can do the back float. But when I went there in college, I was still young enough to enjoy that business that you used to do when you were a kid, where you'd slide up and down the bathtub and set up all those waves. Boy, in those big English bathtubs, you could really get a roll going down there. And it was great fun. But that's the story of El Nino, is a backlash of this warm water coming from, oops, I didn't get in the right spot, Pacific. Coming from over here towards Australia and backlashing this way, all right? And so it's a disruption of the circulation pattern. And of course, you all know its climatic effects. I mean, here's Larry Hagman, right? Star of Dallas, Mary Martin's favorite son. And you were there in 82, his house is at Malibu, he gets wiped out. I mean, the whole thing gets obliterated by the storm surge on the coast, and Larry says, "Well, I was going to redecorate anyway." and this kind of stuff.
I think, if I remember right, watching weather patterns on TV here in the Northwest, if I recall, the weather patterns coming out of the Bering Sea come down and circle this way, and the ones coming up from the coast, I believe I'm right, circle the other way. Could that be?
Well, yes. Yes, it could, because we talk about actually several belts. We talk about the equatorial low, we talk about the subtropical highs, which are actually the high pressures that dominate the world's desert areas. You notice how they all line up, the Sahara, the Arabian, the deserts of the American Southwest, they're all at the same latitude. Those are what we call the subtropical highs. And then we run up into the subpolar lows. And so if you have highs which are spinning one way at 30 to 40 degrees north latitude, and you have the subtropical or subpolar lows which are 40 to 50 degrees north latitude spinning the other way, then that's what you're talking about. They just dovetail in. Yeah, they're going back and forth. Extraordinarily dynamic. Horse latitudes are the subtropical highs. Yeah, where the world's just, and that's true not only in the northern hemisphere, but it's also true in the southern, because you get the Atacama Desert in Chile, and then the Namibian and the Saharan, and of course the great outback of Australia are all there as well. They're under the subtropical highs. So
is El Nino some kind of aberration?
Well,
is there a good theory about it?
Yes and no. It's an aberration on one scale, but not on another. And what happens, and so here's our, what we have here in the southern hemisphere is the patterns go like this. So beaches are nice and warm on Australia, you can all go snorkeling at the Great Barrier Reef, right? But as you come up here on this coast of South America, you have, in essence, the same kind of climates you have along here that you would have along California on the northern hemisphere, sort of thing. And the idea is that the warm waters go this way, okay? But if you get, in essence, a shifting of the belts, all right, these equatorial low, high, low, high, if these things shift enough, why you get, instead of bringing this stuff in here, why the thing moves too far and you get kind of a backwash below it. And at one scale, it's an aberration, but on the other hand, it's not, because there seems to be a cyclicity to it.
Oh, this is...
I said the Peruvians have known about El Nino for several hundred years.
That's what it's named for, the Christ child.
Yeah, the child, because it would show up.
Oh.
It would show up at Christmas.
El Nino, the child.
Okay. All right, well, I'd like to come back a moment to kind of close this off to the business of CFC 11, CFC 12, and to show my utter fearlessness and probably idiocy all at the same time. I'll launch off into a little bit of my perception of history and how historians apply their trade. So here you can just take me over the coals all you want.
You show this happened in the light.
There are three historians at the university where I teach, and one of them could only be described, from my perspective, as Tolstoyan. In that there is this grand sweep to history, and it rolls over the top of all of us, and it produces those people that history needs in certain critical times, so that it, in essence, produces a Wellington or somebody like this, or Napoleon himself. And the sweep of history rolls over and consumes all of us. And actually, that's a summation of War and Peace. So if you've never read the book, now you don't have to. Don't worry about all those all those Russian families. And sort of the other end of the spectrum, we have a professor who is an unabashed conspiratorialist, who thinks that history is the effect and the cause, in essence, are the few, the powerful, that work behind the scenes to control all sorts of things. And the other fellow is sort of stuck in the middle. And I must admit that I find myself more in the middle and toward Tolstoy than way over here on the conspiratorialist side. But we've passed a historical milestone of sorts about 3 years ago in 1989, and it has to do, with respect to the date's discussion, with a fellow, and I think his first name is Thomas. I only remember it by the last name. Yep. It has to do with a fellow by the name of Thomas Midgley. And the milestone has to do with the commemoration of his birthday, which was in 1889, 100 years before, and he passed away in 1944. And Thomas Midgley was an extraordinarily talented inventor, and the son of a talented inventor, and he the son of a talented inventor. And Thomas Midgley, because he had a gift, a very substantial gift, as a chemist, in the teens and 20s, hired on with General Motors Research Laboratory. And in 1930, invented CFCs, CFC 11, CFC 12. And it was very much a single-handed effort. Thomas Midgley is responsible for CFC 11, CFC 12s. He invented them as a substitute for the common refrigerants of the day. There were two common refrigerants of them of the day, and neither of them were very pleasant. One was sulfur dioxide, which could blow up on you very easily, and that was used in refrigerators. And the other one was ammonia, which in high enough concentrations was not pleasant either. And there was a great deal of interest in the refrigeration business in coming up with something that would not blow up and would not be toxic really to inhale and save you from the perils of having to use sulfur dioxide or ammonia, both of which just really desperately needed to be contained in their refrigeration system. CFCs, if a little bit leaked, it was not a big deal. And Midgley sat down with the tools of the age, paper and pencil and a slide rule, and came up with CFCs single-handedly, and revolutionized the business of refrigerants and refrigeration, and also such things as styrofoam, aerosol sprays, this kind of stuff. In 1989, on the 100th anniversary of his death, there were 16 million tons of CFCs in the Earth's atmosphere. This is from 1930. This is an artificial, man-made, person-made construction CFC. There was no background for it whatsoever. It was from scratch in 1930. And we found it a long ways from the General Motors laboratories. We found it high in the stratosphere above Antarctica. And interestingly enough, at about the point in time that the British expedition in Antarctica was observing the destruction of the stratospheric ozone layer and picking up on CFCs, or the chlorine, which is the remains of it, what actually happens and why it's so destructive is that CFCs were designed to be inert, to not break apart. That was what Midgley was after, not to do something that would be dangerous. And the very success of that is part of the problem, because the CFCs floated on up into the stratosphere where they encountered the only thing that could break them apart, ultraviolet radiation, stuff that the ozone up in the stratosphere is supposed to protect us from. And it would break apart those CFCs. And fluorine and chlorine are very nasty substances when it comes to being reactive with other things. Not only are they very nasty, well, I mean, they're very nasty in part because they themselves cause great damage and then move on to do more damage. In scientific parlance, they're catalysts. And they just keep bouncing around and breaking up ozone. But interestingly enough, at the same time that these things were going on, the folks who studied the cryosphere, that was the thing that I had done last week and talked a little bit about yesterday, the folks who studied the cryosphere, the record of the ice, were drilling some holes in the ice cap on Antarctica. And there they came up with Midgley again, because in 1922, about 8 years before he invented chlorofluorocarbons, he invented tetraethyl lead, which you all have grown up with as the lead that's in your gasoline. And when they went to the center of the Antarctic ice cap and they drilled down into the ice, they found that there were somewhat over 200 parts per million lead.